On today's episode, an icon of the Shakespearean stage shows her cheeky side. From the Folger Shakespeare Library, this is Shakespeare Unlimited. I'm Michael Whitmore, the Folger director. Dame Judi Dench fell in love with Shakespeare because of his language. Not his poetry, mind you, his potty mouth. She was in grade school watching her brother in a production of Macbeth and was delighted to hear the word bloody on stage. Dench tells that story in her new book, Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent, co-written with fellow actor and director Brendan O'Hay. And it's one of the first clues to Dench's mischievous, down-to-earth personality. The book takes a form of dialogues between old friends Dench and O'Hay as they discuss each of Dench's Shakespearean roles in turn. In her first professional role, Dench played Ophelia in Hamlet at the Old Vic. She describes her years studying the older members of the Old Vic company as crucial to her training as an actor. Dench would go on to play virtually all of Shakespeare's roster of great roles for women. Lady Macbeth, Viola, Titania, Juliet, Portia, Regan, Cleopatra, Volumnia, Paulina, Gertrude, and many others. She played a few non-Shakespearean parts too, including the title role in Stephen Frears' Philomena, M in 8 of the James Bond films, Granny in Kenneth Branagh's Belfast, and Queen Elizabeth in Shakespeare in Love, for which she won the Oscar. Her co-author Brendan O'Hay has acted in and directed multiple productions at Shakespeare's Globe in London and appeared with Dench in the film Quantum of Solace. Here are Brendan O'Hay and Judi Dench in conversation with Barbara Bogave.
Judi, what a wonderful title, and I understand it's something your husband, Michael Williams, used to call Shakespeare. Do you remember the first time he said it?
I do certainly remember, because I had been at the Vic from 1957 to when I met Michael in 1961 or two, and Michael had been in the other half of the Royal Shakespeare Company. And so he literally was the man who paid our rent and went on being so, thank goodness. Paid mine for a long time. And he just went on being. So that's what he was known as in the house.
And Brendan, though, you say you thought of calling the book Herding Eels. Is Judi that Wrigley?
Oh, dear God. Yes, she had to be coaxed with glasses of champagne, butter-kissed. Yes.
Butter-kissed?
It's sugar popcorn.
It's just very good that we were old friends. We were quite old friends, so we'd known each other very well, Barbara. And as you probably know, it came out of all being closeted up during COVID. And when we were able to get about, it was Brendan's idea. He said, why don't I come down and why don't we talk about all the parts you've played? And so it started in a very kind of lighthearted, kind of jokey way. And fortunately, that's the way it went. It was just like having long conversations, jokey conversations, laughing and eating and drinking and with an old friend.
Well, you really feel that reading the book. It's so full of fun stories. And I'm just thinking of one that just popped into my head that you were talking about Cleopatra and how at one point in this production, you're holed up on stage in the Monument for a long time with two other actors during Antony's suicide attempt. So very serious point of the play.
Well, we were very, very quiet.
Oh, but you're talking about your favorite meals?
Very quiet. Yes, we were. They'd said to me early on in the production, what is the favorite, you know, whispering, so nobody heard us, what is your favorite food? And I happened to say, I'm very partial to lobster, very partial. Lobster and a glass of champagne is my idea of heaven. And then on the last night, when we were there, suddenly they had torches and they put them on, and there was the lobsters on a plate with a glass.
While Anthony Hopkins is doing his best acting.
It was true.
Well, your first Shakespeare role was a biggie. I mean, Ophelia in Hamlet at the Old Vic.
It was.
And you say you got cast straight out of drama school opposite a very seasoned actor, John Neville. Were you terrified?
During my time at Central for 3 years, we used to go to the Vic for ninepence in the balcony to see all the plays. And this is long before the Beatles, but Richard and John were the kind of equivalent of the Beatles that people used to kind of swoon over. We swooned over them. So, yes, it was a chance thing. We did our final show for Central, and which was at the at Wyndham's Theatre, and to which about five casting directors were invited. And one of them was Michael Bentall, who ran the OVIC, and I was invited to go and see him the next day and do a bit of Ophelia, which I learnt. And then I got a message to say, would you go the following day and see him again quietly? Well, there was not, you know, a lot of people auditioning. And I did. And he said, I'm going to take a real huge chance. And he did take the chance. And I'm very pleased that he did, because I, although getting not good notices at all as Ophelia, because I was, you know, complete newcomer, I knew nothing really about it. He did say to me, I'm going to keep you on, Judy, if you'd like to, and you can understudy and play parts and just watch other actors. That's exactly what I did.
He said something very interesting to you, that he told you you have to make your speaking more legato. So what did that mean to you?
When you're untrained, you might say, my lord, I have remembrances of yours that I have longed long to re-deliver. I pray you now receive. He actually meant just take the time to say it. My lord, I have remembrances of yours that I have longed long to re-deliver. I pray you now receive them. It means just taking time and a breath and not being quite so anxious. And then be able to manipulate the rhythm a little bit. I can remember Roy Kinnear, when he was going to Stratford for the first time to be in The Taming of the Shrew. He had never done Shakespeare before, and he opens the play with Gentleman in Portrait Me No Further. And he said, he rang Trevor Nunn the night before. He said, I'm very worried about the iambic pentameter of the speech and things. I'm a bit worried. And Trevor said, don't worry, it's just da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Don't worry about it at all. No concern. And when they came to the rehearsal, they said, right, we'll start now. And Roy said, Gentlemen, importune me no further. And they were absolutely out. And everybody then suddenly had a class in speaking it and, you know, how that you have to obey it, but not make the audience aware so much that perhaps it is, that it's written in the, or maybe you have to make the audience aware that it's written in the meter. I don't know. Brendan, say something.
I'm listening to you.
You know how to do it.
Yes.
Brendan, you pick up on so many interesting things in this book that Judy says. And one of the things you pick up on, since we're talking about Hamlet, is Judy's sympathy for Polonius, which I love because I always think of him as such a conniving, social, climbing, obsequious, just manipulative ass. So, were you surprised that Judy was so generous in her impressions of him?
Well yeah, but then I think in the book, I asked the question, does it take being a parent to understand what he's going through? And then Jude then obviously speaks incredibly eloquently about how he's a single parent. And yes, he's a buffoon and he's a busybody and he says, you know, 10 words when one will do. But you kind of allowed me to see the human side to him and what he goes through. You're right, Barbara. It's too easy to see him as a kind of pantomime buffoon, but he isn't. He's much more than that. But did you realise that when you were playing Ophelia, Jude?
No, I don't think so. I think that's what's so wonderful about these plays. You may, in your imagination, understand the actions of a parent, but when you actually become a parent, then you experience what those actions are. And that's why you can do a Shakespeare play a couple of times. But in the in the sequence of your own life and your experience, something will happen that actually you suddenly realise, like, for instance, the death of one of your parents or both your parents. You know, suddenly you experience something that only in your imagination have you had to experience if you've done the play before. And so constantly you're bringing your own experience to something, to a rehearsal process, or certainly with your association with the other actors on stage, and definitely to the play that you didn't understand before.
You also played Gertrude later on, and your Hamlet was Daniel Day-Lewis, who infamously had a kind of nervous breakdown during a performance.
He did.
Did you sense his turmoil during the run?
No. No. I mean, no, I didn't. I knew of his tremendous affection for his father, and that his father had died. And that evening, it was it was something that suddenly overwhelmed him in the middle of the play. And he just, I suppose, had a sort of breakdown in the middle, and we paused, and I raced up the stairs to see Jeremy Northam, who was his understudy. And I said, when was the last time you had a rehearsal for this? And I think he said something like, oh, about 2.5, 3 weeks ago. And anyway, he did brilliantly, Jeremy. But, playing Hamlet, my goodness, the demands on you, not only physically and vocally, but emotionally, are very great indeed. And if you had something like that happen, I can see why you might have to suddenly stop the play.
Yeah, plenty of other Hamlets have had issues and carried the part home with them. Well, on a very different note, I love that you call Gertrude Dirty Gertie.
Dirty Gertie. Not often, only in private.
Well, I mean, she is so sexual. And you and Daniel Day-Lewis did play up the incestuousness and kissed each other on the lips. Whose idea was that?
Oh, I don't know. Both of us, maybe. I don't know.
Just happened. There's so many zigzags of emotion going on in that scene. It seems to me like it must be complicated to...
In the closet scene.
Yeah, in the closet scene. How do you roll with them?
You just do. You just go and you just play them. And I don't think the audience probably realise how important their contribution to a play is. You can feel, actors can feel the atmosphere of an audience very, very quickly.
What do you feel? This is so fascinating to me.
It's to do with tension, I think, isn't it, Brendan? It's to do with tension.
Well, let's see what Brendan says. I mean, how do you know, Brendan? Because you're an actor as well as a director. How do you know when the audience is lost? And just to add in this scene, this closet scene with Hamlet and Gertrude, and Polonius is lying there dead on the floor. Right? I get irrationally peeved sometimes in this scene because Hamlet and Gertrude are going through this whole big psychodrama, but he's dead there. You've got a body, for Christ's sake, still.
He's not dead at the beginning of the scene.
No, but at the end.
Polonius, he stabs him through the arras.
Yes.
Yes, he does, but not at the beginning.
No, but what Barbara's saying is that the mother and son are playing out this psychodrama while there's a dead man behind the arras.
Isn't he killed at the end of it?
No, he's killed at
the end. Doesn't he hear a rat?
He's killed.
He thinks it's overheard.
That's right.
He thinks somebody's listening. He thinks the king's there.
But that's at the beginning of the scene. That's at the beginning of the scene.
It's the beginning of the scene.
And then they have this extraordinary, as Barbara says.
Oh, I need to go back and do this again. I need to go right back and do it again and act. There's a dead man behind the arras.
Well, you were asked to play Polonius in Ian McKellen's production. Do you remember what you replied?
I did, right back, and said, I'm not suitable for the part of Polonius, besides which there isn't an arras large enough in the country to hide my arse. Polonius,
forgive us, Barbara.
I want to talk now about Macbeth, because you say it's a favourite play of yours, and also it was the reason you went into theater. So what production of Macbeth was it, and what about it appealed to you so much?
It was a production done at St. Peter's School, York, which my brother, my oldest brother, who became a doctor like my father, but was in, and I was taken to it. So I think I was probably 8. And my brother walked on and said, "What bloody man is that?" And I thought, oh, please, this is swearing and this is Shakespeare. This is for me. I can't remember thinking. I thought, bloody, he said, bloody man. Well, nobody said bloody in those days. What bloody man is that? Oh, I thought, so exciting. and then subsequently, of course, they did a lot of plays of Shakespeare, and I was taken to them all. We were great theatre goers, my family.
But you say as a kid you wanted to be a set designer.
Yes, I did. I trained. That's all I wanted to be. I went to York Art School, and that's the life I thought I would leave, to be a set and costume designer. And then I was taken to Stratford by my parents in 1953 to see Michael Redgrave as King Lear. The set was designed by a man called Robert Colquhoun, and it was just a huge, flat, round, looked like a poppadom, actually. Huge, flat, uneven surface that was a revolve. And in the middle was a huge rock, which was either a cave or a throne or anything else it needed to be. So consequently, nobody brought on scenery, nobody brought off scenery, and the play was continuous. And it made an incredible impression on me. And is what changed my mind.
Because it was just, you couldn't even imagine coming up with something like that?
I couldn't imagine that. I thought, that isn't in my imagination. That would never be something that I could have thought up.
Well, what made you think that you would like acting more?
I mean, the war broke out when I was 5, and I was brought up, no television. We just had bicycles, and we swam a lot, and we roller skated a lot, and we read books, and we saw plays, and drew, and always drew. My father painted, and my brother painted, and I've painted, and that's the kind of life we had. And so the only alternative, it seemed to me, was acting, because I love the theatre so much.
That's interesting that how you described your childhood, because when I was reading the parts about your process and how you prepare for a role, you wrote things like doing the work for you means you have a photographic memory and you learn the lines, but then you cannot sit still and you go off and you go for walks and you swim and you play cards. Anything in order to let it, what is it doing?
What is it doing?
Simmering you?
Taking up a lot of extra energy and things. I mean, you can be very, very serious on stage, and then you can be amazingly larky in the dressing room. And, you know, somehow, now looking back on all the tragedies I've played, of the levity of everybody off stage, it seems to me to be much more present if you're doing a tragedy. And if you're doing a comedy, people are rather somber. I mean, I only say that because of Macbeth. When we did Macbeth at the other place, Ian McKellen and I, I mean, the larks we all got up to during the half was unbelievable. Just very, very funny jokes and laughing and people. And then somehow you can distill something. And if you get rid, it's like beer. If you think of the glass of beer with a froth on the top, if you're going to do a tragedy, you have to get to the essence of it. You have to get rid of the froth. And in a way, that is the only comparison I can think of. What do you think, Brandon?
Yeah, Brendan, what do you think? Is it a matter of energy, like saving the energy?
Oh, a comedy is much harder because you have to go for the truth and play the scene, but you also have an ear out listening to the timing of a joke and the audience's reaction to that.
You have to go for the truth in tragedy too.
Well, all right. Sorry, I was under the impression you asked me a question then.
Brendan, this is interesting question for you as a director. Judy talks a lot about how you have to do the work before you show up in the rehearsal room, and sometimes other actors, you notice, want to do the work in the rehearsal room. But I've talked to a lot of directors on this program, and for instance, Greg Doran talks about all the exercises they do and how so much of the work is done in rehearsal. What about you? What's your thought on that? Are you okay with actors coming in with less formed ideas and complete prep?
Well, sometimes, you know, and I know that as being an actor, you can overthink something. You come into the room and then you're not open to what, obviously, the director gives you, but more importantly, what the other actors give you. And it has to be a collaborative relationship. One of the best directors I worked with was the late Stephen Pimlott. I did a production of King Lear with him in Chichester with the great David Warner playing King Lear, who was, for me, one of the greatest performances I've ever seen. And Stephen Pimlott on day one said, I know the meaning of every single line. I know where everybody should be on stage. I know everybody's motivation, but I've left all of that outside the door. And what I want is what you bring into the room. And if I need to refer back to my own homework, that's fine. And I thought for me, that was incredibly helpful. And I try to obviously I have to do the research and do the prep and all of that, but you have to leave a lot at the door, because the collective, you know, 10 bodies in a room will come up with many, many more better ideas than I certainly will as an individual. And you have to be open to that. You can't be too prescriptive as a director.
While we're talking about directors, Judy, you often say how much you enjoy working with Trevor Nunn, and we were talking about Macbeth, and you the second time you were Lady Macbeth, it was in 1976 with Trevor Nunn directing. What kind of director is he? What do you love so much about working with him, and what does he focus on?
He has a great sense of humor, and that for me is very, very important, because unless you can really laugh and push it to its limit, I don't think you can then cry or push the limit of grief to whatever level. And so working on it every day, the intensity of it, was absolutely intense to the extreme. But afterwards, he remembers that all I would say is, how many handstands can you do against this wall on the way walking back to where we were all living? I mean, it is an extraordinary thing that when you're doing a tragedy, the tension is so great that you have to somehow relieve it, and Trevor's wonderful about that. He just remembers so many jokes and things that didn't go on in rehearsal room, but nevertheless, when it burst out of that tension of rehearsing for so many hours, 6 hours or whatever, suddenly you got very silly.
well, and also humour in a room or the ability to have fun in a room allows you to fail more, and it's only by failing do you arrive at
absolutely
the truth, I suppose, or your own performance. You find what your mean is, where you need to be with the play. You talk sometimes about directors you've worked with who haven't made you feel safe or have been a little tyrannical in the room. And
yes,
then you can't go there, can you? Because you're too...
No.
It's based on fear.
Well, you don't dare then to do anything.
Mm. I was listening to that production and to that first scene where you have the famous line, says Lady Macbeth, "Come you spirits.
Come you spirits. Come you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts. Unsex me here and fill me from the crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood. Stop up the access and passage to remorse, that no compunctious visitings of nature shake my fell purpose, nor keep peace between the effect and it. Come to my woman's breasts.
my milk for gall. You murdering ministers. Wherever in your sightless substances you wait on nature's mischief. Come, thick night, and pour thee in the dunnest smoke of hell, that my keen knife see not the wound it makes, nor heaven peep through the blanket of the dark to cry, hold, hold.
The other day I saw Ian McKellen, and I haven't seen him for a long, long time. And I said to him, funnily enough, a couple of nights before seeing him, I thought of our production, and suddenly realized that Lady Macbeth is much more of a villain than Macbeth is. She actually, her first lines, when she reads the letter that he said about the witches, she talks about him and then says, Glamis thou art, and Cawdor, and shalt be what thou art promised. Then she says, yet do I fear thy nature. It is too full of the milk of human kindness to catch the nearest way. Thou wouldst be great, art not without ambition, but without the illness should attend it. And then she goes on, and I think, I'm not sure that it's ever been played, that Macbeth is a quite innocent, startled man by the witches at the beginning, and hears their prophecy, and she's the one who takes it up and says, ah, ha, 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 no, 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 you're going to have exactly what you want. If you want to be king, and if it means killing somebody else, I'll be there with you. Do you know? Does it make sense?
It does, but that doesn't make her evil. That
evil.
Well, you said evil. Or more of a villain.
It makes her ambitious.
So pleased I'm not being directed by him at this moment.
It makes her ambitious, which I was going to ask you. Where does her ambition come from, and who is it for? Is it for her or her husband, or are they the one?
I think that I've always said, I think their relationship is passionate. And I think if that's what he wants, then that is exactly, I will aid him in getting what he wants. And if it means the murder of the king, okay, we'll have him round.
Were you and Ian McKellen talking about this? Is that why you were talking about it?
We did. I hadn't seen Ian for ages. And we were, our very dear friend of ours, Bill Kenwright, died. And this was a memorial. And Finty, my daughter, and I did something at the very beginning because Bill Kenwright meant a great deal to us. And so we did our bit. And Ian was appearing later. And after we'd rehearsed, suddenly there was a knock on the door and there was Ian. So we were able to catch up after I haven't seen him for a long time.
Well, he told some lovely stories about you getting up to hijinks at Buckingham Palace with him when he was on the podcast. Sneaking into the throne room, did you, to have a smoke?
I can remember him sitting on a chair and thinking, good grief, is this the throne of England? I'm changing my pants. I'd forgotten. He had quick back. Gosh, how badly we behaved.
In that same production, I love that story, Jude, you say about, because you always say that you love knowing that there's somebody in the audience to play it to. And it could be a stranger, of course, you'd think each night. And then one night you decided who you're going to play Macbeth for when you were at the other place. And you said to Ian.
Yes, as Brenda said, I didn't know anybody in that night. And I just think it's a very nice thing to give a present to somebody if you know that they're there. So you do the performance for them. So I said to Ian, I'm going to pretend, Ian, tonight, that God the Father, Jesus Christ and the Holy Ghost have bought three seats at the front. I'm going to do it for them, I said. Ian said, it's perfectly fine, Judy, except they'll only want one seat, he said.
He's so quick. So quick.
I love it.
I know I have to let you go soon, but I have to leave a little time for Titania, or as you call her, Tits, in Midsummer Night's Dream.
No, my daughter has two cats, and they're called Oberon and Titania, and they're known as Ron and Tits. So that's how that.
Oh, I thought it was a joke because a lot of our audience might not remember, but that production, I think it took place during the 70s, is it? When everyone was topless, basically, in Shakespeare, it seemed like.
In the film, yes.
Mm.
Well, I played it at school. Then I played First Fairy at the Vic. Then I played Hermia at the Vic. Then I played Titania at Stratford, and then I played Titania again for Peter.
At the Rose Theatre, Kingston.
The Rose in Kingston. Ian Richardson, oh, he was absolutely the most beautiful actor. He played Oberon, and you know, then you have to just, in your mind, work out what this... They're terribly jealous of each other, and she... She's very angry with him, he with her. And as she says, then she says that wonderful speech about the seasons. Because of us, the seasons have all gone out of kilter. That long speech about, you know, the ox hath therefore stretched his yoke in vain. The ploughman lost his sweat, and the green corn hath rotted ere his youth attained a beard.
The fold stands empty in the drowned field, and crows are fatted with the Murrian flock. The nine men's morris is filled up with mud, and the quaint mazes in the wanton green, for lack of tread, are indistinguishable. The human mortals want their winter cheer. No night is now with hymn or carol blessed. Therefore the moon, the governess of floods, pale in her anger, washes all the air, that rheumatic diseases do abound. And thorough this distemperature we see, the seasons alter. Hoary-headed frosts fall in the fresh lap of the crimson rose, and on old Higham's thin and icy crown, an odorous chaplet of sweet summer buds is as in mockery said. The spring, the summer, the childing autumn, angry winter, change their wonted liveries, and the mazed world, by their increase now knows not which is which.
And then he says at the end of it, and all this comes from our debate, we are their parents and original. And in fact, that speech, I've thought, actually at the moment, would be so pertinent because of, I mean, I don't know about you, we have nothing but rain this spring, nothing but rain. And everything is, you know, so...
And the world is koyana squatsy. Everything's upside down.
Everything, yes.
Yes. Judy, I want to ask you about soliloquies. For instance, let's, as an example, Viola's in Twelfth Night, her soliloquy, "O time, thou must untangle this, not I." Do you think of that as a dialogue with the audience or an internal argument? Or do you always approach a soliloquy as situational, what's going on in the play at that moment?
No, it's telling the story. It's actually telling the story to the audience. It's something you share, and maybe not with the other person on stage, but you do with the audience. The audience are let in on the play, aren't they? So they know. But you always have an ear out for the audience, because every single audience is different.
We disagreed a bit about this, didn't we? I think because of my experience working at the Globe as an actor, because the audience are visible scene partners, that you can only but have a dialogue with them. You can't ignore them. So it has to be a conversation with them where they happen to not answer back.
They answer back at the Globe.
Sometimes
don't
they do, and that's absolutely thrilling. But I suppose it's different in a proscenium arch theatre where they're passive spectators sitting
yes,
in the dark.
Yes.
What do they say back to you at the Globe?
Oh, I've had pigeons defecate on me. I've had babies cry. Why are you laughing? I've had babies cry. Yes, no, it's been, but it's thrilling. People faint. No, that's thrilling. It's less to do with what they say and more to do with a kind of reaction of people just walking out and shuffling around. But that's great because they're feral when they're at their best, especially the groundlings. You just have to kind of hold them there. But it can only but be a dialogue, those soliloquies, which I think is different to a proscenium arch theatre where, as I say, the audience is sitting in the dark. Talking of pigeons and birds, you have a parrot, Jude, that you're trying to teach Shakespeare.
Yes, but my parrot won't play up. My parrot says lots and lots of words. She's called Sweetie, and she I was given her 3 years ago, I thought, oh, this is a parrot that doesn't speak. And then one day somebody came into my kitchen, walked past, she said, "You're a slag," she said to her. So I thought, oh, she does speak. But she says, Sweetie says, "Shh." So I go, "Shh." She goes, "Shh." So we do that for a long time, but I've been going Shakespeare. No, not a bean.
She cannot be directed.
I've tried. Yes, but I'm going to get Brendan to try.
But she knows how to do the pop of champagne and champagne. Honestly, when champagne being poured into a glass, you'd be amazed. It is uncanny. That tells you a lot about the owner of the parrot.
But she also does that very nice thing. When she sees the bottle, she makes the sound of it being poured. Very clever parrot.
I probably don't even have to ask this question now, given how you all are talking right now. It's clear you're a very spontaneous and playful person. But I was trying to pin down what makes you so wonderfully present and real on stage. And then I read that you have a Quaker background and you sometimes go to Quaker meeting, which surprised me. So does your Quaker experience, you think, have any relationship to your work as an actor?
I expect every relationship, everything. That thing of sitting in a room with a whole group of people, maybe silent for an hour. Not very usual, but it has happened. And some kind of communion between everybody sitting there, shared thing. Maybe that, I mean, it is very important to me in my life. I suppose it's part of my work. I don't know. I like being with people. I don't like being on my own. And so I love sharing things with people. Just sharing an atmosphere.
Champagne.
So I suppose that has got a lot to do with champagne as well. Yes, I suppose that has got a lot to do with it.
But to spare your blushes, Jude, I think you do throw the focus on other people. Someone once said that to be interesting, you have to be interested. And I think that's true of good friends, or good lovers, but also certainly good actors. And you do. I think you always put the focus on the other actor. And I think that's what makes you, you're kind of without vanity in a way.
And oh, really?
How
do I look?
Wretched. You throw the focus onto other actors. And
Brendan, I don't know if you quoted Peter Hall, or this is reminding me of something Peter Hall, the director, once said, that the irony of theater is that the mask brings out the authentic.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah,
oh,
it's a wonderful quote. I'm not sure I understand it, but I've always taken it to mean that since an actor is playing another person, they're distracted from themselves and their issues and their problems and their hang-ups.
Oh, I think that's absolutely wonderful.
So do I.
On a similar vein, Declan Donnellan says, he asks the question, do you play a part in order to lose yourself, or do you play a part in order to find yourself? And I think that's wonderful as well. But you're right, that mask thing that Peter Hall said, yes, it's true. And I think what's, dare I say it, about this book, I mean, we didn't know what category to put it under, whether it's under Shakespeare or memoir or biography, but I think by talking about Shakespeare and especially these characters, I think Jude has probably revealed more about herself in this book than she certainly has in the other books that have been written about her or by her. But I think because she hasn't been the focus.
Was there anything that she forbade you to include?
Oh, God.
What are you going to say?
Well, let's just say...
Oh, what are you going to say?
Let's just say the next book we've talked about is Lovers I've Known. Volume one. It'll be longer than Gibbons's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire.
That's because I'm going to be actually interviewing you.
No, no, no. Mine will be a pamphlet compared to yours. Yes, yeah.
I can't wait to read the four volumes, but I'm so lucky that I got to spend this time with both of you. And thank you so much for your generous sharing.
Barbara, thank you very much indeed.
It's been a pleasure, Barbara. Thank you.
It's been lovely.
That was Dame Judi Dench and Brendan O'Hay talking with Barbara Bogave. Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent, is out now from St. Martin's Press. This episode was produced by Matt Frassica. Garland Scott is the associate producer. It was edited by Gail Kern Pastor. Ben Lauer is the web producer with help from Leonor Fernandez. We had technical help from London Broadcast Studios and Voice Tracks West in Studio City, California. Final mixing services provided by Clean Cuts at 3Cs Inc. If you're a fan of Shakespeare Unlimited, please leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice to help others find the show. Shakespeare Unlimited comes to you from the Folger Shakespeare Library. Home to the world's largest Shakespeare collection, the Folger is dedicated to advancing knowledge in the arts. Our building in Washington, D.C. has been under construction for the past 4 years, but we're looking forward to reopening fully on June 21st, 2024. You can find more about the Folger at our website, folger.edu. Thanks for listening. For the Folger Shakespeare Library, I'm Folger Director Michael Whitmore.